Do you wish to divorce me? Oh, wouldn't you like that? Wouldn't that be a smart trade to pull? Don't you suppose I know that you've wanted to divorce me since the first month of our marriage? If that is what you thought, why did you stay with me? She answered severely, It's a question you have lost the right to ask. That's true, he said, thinking that only one conceivable reason, her love for him, could justify her answer. No, I'm not going to divorce you. Do you suppose that I will allow your romance with a floozy to deprive me of my home, my name, my social position? I shall preserve such pieces of my life as I can, whatever does not rest on so shoddy a foundation as your fidelity. Make no mistake about it, I shall never give you a divorce. Whether you like it or not, you're married, and you'll stay married. I will, if that is what you wish. And furthermore, I will not consider... Incidentally, why don't you sit down? He remained standing. Please, say what you have to say. I will not consider any unofficial divorce, such as a separation. You may continue your love idle in the subways and basements where it belongs, but in the eyes of the world, I will expect you to remember that I am Mrs. Henry Reardon. You have always proclaimed such an exaggerated devotion to honesty. Now let me see you be condemned to the life of the hypocrite that you really are. I will expect you to maintain your residence at the home which is officially yours, but will now be mine, if you wish. She leaned back loosely, in a manner of untidy relaxation, her legs spread apart, her arms resting in two strict parallels on the arms of the chair, like a judge who could permit himself to be sloppy. Divorce, she said, chuckling coldly. Did you think you'd get off as easily as that? Did you think you'd get by at the price of a few of your millions tossed off as alimony? You're so used to purchasing whatever you wish by the simple means of your dollars that you cannot conceive of things that are non-commercial, non-negotiable, non-subject to any kind of trade. You're unable to believe that there may exist a person who feels no concern for money. You cannot imagine what that means. Well, I think you're going to learn. Oh, yes, of course, you'll agree to any demand I make from now on. I want you to sit in that office of which you're so proud, in those precious mills of yours, and play the hero who works 18 hours a day, the giant of industry who keeps the whole country going, the genius who is above the common herd of whining, lying, chiseling humanity. Then I want you to come home and face the only person who knows you for what you really are, who knows the actual value of your word, of your honor, of your integrity, of your vaunted self-esteem. I want you to face in your own home the one person who despises you and has the right to do so. I want you to look at me whenever you build another furnace or pour another record-breaking load of steel, or hear applause and admiration, whenever you feel proud of yourself, whenever you feel clean, whenever you feel drunk on the sense of your own greatness. I want you to look at me whenever you hear of some act of depravity, or feel anger at human corruption, or feel contempt for someone's knavery, or are the victim of a new governmental extortion. To look and to know that you're no better, that you're superior to no one, that there's nothing you have the right to condemn. I want you to look at me and to learn the fate of the man who tried to build a tower to the sky, or the man who wanted to reach the sun on wings made of wax. Or you, the man who wanted to hold himself as perfect. Somewhere outside of him, and apart, as if he were reading it in a brain not his own, he observed the thought that there was some flaw in the scheme of the punishment she wanted him to bear, something wrong by its own terms, aside from its propriety or justice, some practical miscalculation that would demolish it all if discovered. He did not attempt to discover it. The thought went by as a moment's notation, made in cold curiosity, to be brought back in some distant future. There was nothing within him now with which to feel interest or to respond. His own brain was numb with the effort to hold the last of his sense of justice against so overwhelming a tide of revulsion that it swamped Lillian out of human form, past all his pleas to himself that he had no right to feel it. If she was loathsome, he thought, it was he who had brought her to it. This was her way of taking pain. No one could prescribe the form of a human being's attempt to bear suffering. No one could blame. Above all, not he who had caused it. But he saw no evidence of pain in her manner. Then perhaps the ugliness was the only means she could summon to hide it, he thought. Then he thought of nothing except of withstanding the revulsion for the length of the next moment, and of the next. When she stopped speaking, he asked, "Have you finished?"
"Yes, I believe so."
"Then you had better take the train home now." When he undertook the motions necessary to remove his evening clothes, he discovered that his muscles felt as if he were at the end of a long day of physical labor. His starched shirt was limp with sweat. There was neither thought nor feeling left in him, nothing but a sense that merged the remnants of both. The sense of congratulation upon the greatest victory he had ever demanded of himself. That Lillian had walked out of the hotel suite alive. Entering Reardon's office, Dr. Floyd Ferris wore the expression of a man so certain of the success of his quest that he could afford a benevolent smile. He spoke with a smooth, cheerful assurance. Reardon had the impression that it was the assurance of a card sharp who has spent a prodigious effort in memorizing every possible variation of the pattern and is now safe in the knowledge that every card in the deck is marked. "Well, Mr. Reardon," he said by way of greeting, "I didn't know that even a hardened hound of public functions and shaker of famous hands like myself could still get a thrill out of meeting an eminent man. But that's what I feel right now, believe it or not." "How do you do?" said Reardon. Dr. Ferris sat down and made a few remarks about the colors of the leaves in the month of October, as he had observed them by the roadside on his long drive from Washington, undertaken specifically for the purpose of meeting Mr. Reardon in person. Reardon said nothing. Dr. Ferris looked out the window and commented on the inspiring sight of the Reardon Mills, which he said were one of the most valuable productive enterprises in the country. "That is not what you thought of my product a year and a half ago," said Reardon. Dr. Ferris gave a brief frown, as if a dot of the pattern had slipped and almost cost him the game, then chuckled as if he had recaptured it. "That was a year and a half ago, Mr. Reardon," he said easily. "Times change, and people change with the times, the wise ones do. Wisdom lies in knowing when to remember and when to forget. Consistency is not a habit of mind, which it is wise to practice, or to expect of the human race." He then proceeded to discourse upon the foolishness of consistency in a world where nothing was absolute except the principle of compromise. He talked earnestly, but in a casual manner, as if both understood that this was not the main subject of their interview. Yet, oddly, he spoke not in the tone of a foreword, but in the tone of a postscript, as if the main subject had been settled long ago. Reardon waited for the first, "Don't you think so?" and answered, "Please state the urgent matter for which you requested this appointment." Dr. Ferris looked astonished and blank for a moment, then said brightly, as if remembering an unimportant subject which could be disposed of without effort, "Oh, that? That was in regard to the dates of delivery of Reardon metal to the State Science Institute. We should like to have 5,000 tons by the 1st of December, and then we'll be quite agreeable to waiting for the balance of the order until after the 1st of the year." Reardon sat looking at him silently for a long time. Each passing moment had the effect of making the gay intonations of Dr. Ferris's voice, still hanging in the air of the room, seem more foolish. When Dr. Ferris had begun to dread that he would not answer at all, Reardon answered, "Hasn't the traffic cop with the leather leggings whom you sent here given you a report on his conversation with me?" "Why, yes, Mr. Reardon, but what else do you want to hear?" "But that was 5 months ago, Mr. Reardon. A certain event has taken place since, which makes me quite sure that you have changed your mind, and that you will make no trouble for us at all, just as we will make no trouble for you." "What event?" "An event of which you have far greater knowledge than I." "But you see, I do have knowledge of it, even though you would much prefer me to have none." "What event?" "Since it is your secret, Mr. Reardon, why not let it remain a secret? Who doesn't have secrets nowadays? For instance, Project X is a secret. You realize, of course, that we could obtain your metal simply by having it purchased in smaller quantities by various government offices, who would then transfer it to us, and you would not be able to prevent it. But this would necessitate our letting a lot of lousy bureaucrats. Dr. Ferris smiled with disarming frankness. Oh, yes, we are as unpopular with one another as we are with you private citizens. It would necessitate our letting a lot of other bureaucrats in on the secret of Project X, which would be highly undesirable at this time. And so would any newspaper publicity about the project, if we put you on trial for refusal to comply with a government order. But if you had to stand trial on another, much more serious charge, where Project X and the State Science Institute were not involved, and where you could not raise any issue of principle or arouse any public sympathy, why, that would not inconvenience us at all, but it would cost you more than you would care to contemplate. Therefore, the only practical thing for you to do is to help us keep our secret, and get us to help you keep yours. And, as I'm sure you realize, we are fully able to keep any of the bureaucrats safely off your trail for as long as we wish. What event, what secret, and what trail? Oh, come, Mr. Reardon, don't be childish. The 4,000 tons of Reardon metal, which you delivered to Ken Daniger, of course, said Dr. Ferris lightly.